Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com. The archives or podcasts are located on the radio show's page of richarddugan.com, and we are linked to our guests, and we encourage you to go to our guests' website so that you can continue your investigation, your research, continue to be inspired and enlightened by what they have to share. Find out what resonates with you. Run with it, if you will. We place out this giant table, this smorgasbord, and we ask you to partake of those things that that work for you. Come back time and time again, because as you change and grow and evolve, new things are going to open up to you that may not have today. So we encourage you to do just that. We have a return guest to our program. I'm very excited about that, as well as the conversation we're going to have. Dr. Susan Chomsky is our guest here on the program, and we're very excited about talking not only with her, but about the subject that we're going to be dealing with. And it is a book that she has put out, and it's in celebration of, if you will, or at least in connection with, the 50th anniversary of the Beatles and Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in India. It's where they, and again, I'm going to learn a lot about this because I was seven, okay? And so I wasn't following a lot of the stuff that was going on, nor have I kept up with it. But it's called Maharishi and Me, Seeking Enlightenment with the Beatles Guru. And first of all, thank you so much for joining us on the program again. It's great to have you back.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here with you today.
And I also must compliment you on your punctuation. And the reason I say that is because so many people, they do not understand the importance and significance of the apostrophe and how it's placed. And I'm serious. I am sorry. But for example, we're talking about the Beatles. All right. Now, the Beatles always ends in an S. Okay. But I bet you 9 times out of 10, someone's going to say, if they were just to say the phrase seeking enlightenment with the Beatles' guru, they will put an extra S. They do that with Jesus, Jesus's apostles. So, it's a big bugaboo with me in terms of a proper pronunciation and punctuation. And so when you're dealing with someone who has an S at the end of their name or title, and you're going to say, let's say it's their guru, there's just an apostrophe. It's Jesus' apostles and the Beatles' guru. And speaking of which, he is the founder of Transcendental Meditation. You spent time in his presence as well at that time, correct? I mean, that's what this whole book is all about.
Well, the book is about my experiences living in the ashrams and on the personal staff of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. I was in his ashrams for 22 years, his various ashrams, and I was on his personal staff for 6 of those years.
Now, this it's been 50 years, as I was mentioning earlier, since the Beatles left Rishikesh, India. Why did they leave in a huff? And again, I'm not privy to all of this information. I know that many people have studied. They I'm sorry, but some people actually go to the level of worshiping the Beatles. But why did they leave in such a huff if this was such a wonderful place and they were learning so much and even wrote an album, the White Album, there?
Well, very few people know why they left India, actually. They have some ideas about it, most of which are myths. People have all kinds of ideas about why they left India and why it was actually John and George, why they left in a huff on April 10th of 1968. The other Beatles had already left. Ringo left after being there for about 2 weeks. And that's because, first of all, his wife hated insects, and there were quite a number of insects there. In fact, there was scorpions and millipedes and centipedes and all kinds of bizarre insects in India. And she was held hostage by one single fly and refused to go anywhere until her husband returned back to their lodgings so that he could take care of the fly. So they were not really happy there. She was, like I said, she was unhappy about the insects. He was unhappy about the food because of his weak stomach. He was unable to handle whatever food was being served to him there in Rishikesh. And also they really missed the kids. Their kids were very, very young when they went to Rishikesh, and they wanted to get back to the kids. There was nothing really that negative about it, except for the fact that Ringo, Mal Evans, who was their road manager, he had managed to get eggs for Ringo for breakfast. And eggs were not allowed in the ashram because it's a holy area. Mm-hmm. Rishikesh and Haridwar are holy cities in the foothills of the Himalayas. And eggs and meat, anything, fish, eggs, meat, anything that you would eat that is not vegetarian is not allowed there. You can't purchase it there. You're not allowed to eat it there. It's really an ordinance, believe it or not, in those holy towns, which are Hindu, and Hindus are supposed to be vegetarian. So they served him eggs, and then the people, the staff that were working at the ashram, they tried to bury the eggshells, but they were caught burying the eggshells. And Ringo said, well, can't God see that too? That was his comment on the burying of the eggshells. Nah. So that particular incident, it actually kind of made him feel, well, you know, maybe this isn't so spiritual after all. He was a little bit disillusioned by that. So that was another reason why he left. And he felt like he didn't quite get everything out of it that he wanted. But he did say positive things to the press, and especially in recent years, he said very positive things to the press, such as the Maharishi, he gave me this mantra and no one can take that away from me. And he just waxes very positively about the benefits he's had from transcendental meditation. So that's the reason he left. Now, he left after 2 weeks. Like I said, Paul McCartney left after about 1 month. And the only reason he left was because the woman that he was with, which was his girlfriend, Jane Asher, had a theatrical commitment back in London, and they had to leave. All right, so those two Beatles, they certainly didn't leave in a huff. However, George and John did leave in a huff. And why they left in a huff, well, that's quite a long story. Shall I start that long story about that?
Well, what was it about Maharishi that you found so intriguing and that you felt it necessary to travel halfway around the world to spend the next, in this case, 22 years with him?
Well, I certainly didn't know I was going to be spending 22 years with him when I left for India in 1969, when I was 21 years old. But I was completely enamored with transcendental meditation, and I was enamored with Maharishi as well, and I really wanted to become a meditation teacher. So my desire to study with him in Rishikesh, India was very, very strong, and I had tried to apply to three times to take that course in India. And I kept getting rejected because they said I was too young. They kept telling me, you're too young, you're too young, you're too young, because there was a requirement that you be, I can't remember, it was either 24 or 27 years old and graduated college already. And there I was at age 19 when I first applied to take the course. And so when they actually finally accepted me and I received the acceptance, I was so shocked, couldn't believe it. And I had spent such a long time trying to save up the money to go. And then I already spent it all because I didn't think I would be accepted. but I really was accepted. So I was thrilled, but I didn't have the money. But then when I told my parents about it, they said, well, you know, you don't know this, but there's some stock in your name and the stock has split. And so you have enough money to go. And my mom said, well, your dad can't very well object because it's your money. So I went to India very young, like I said, 21 years old. I was when I left for India, and I spent 6 months there at that time. There was the teacher training course for 3 months, and then I spent another 3 months with me and only five other people. So this was in 1970. So I had this time to be with Maharishi, and hardly anybody was there. That was quite unusual, and we traveled down to Bangalore with him. And I fell into spiritual love with him because being around Maharishi was such an incredible experience. He was a very, very unusual person, not somebody that you would meet every day. He was the happiest person I'd ever met in my life. And he exuded this joy, this charisma that was beyond anything I'd ever experienced before. To be around him, it was so joyful, and you just felt like you were being loved to a degree that you had never been loved before. The love that radiates from an enlightened spiritual master is not like any other kind of love. It's divine love. It's pure, unconditional love. And it's so profound, and you feel it. It's tangible. This kind of energy that flows from him when you're in his presence. So that was, it's actually almost, it's like addictive or something. You're in this presence. You're in this heavenly kind of experience. And at the same time, those of us who spent a lot of time in his presence, as I did, there was an added feature to that. And that is that anytime you were in his presence, you felt like there was no reality to the physical world. You felt that this place, this presence around him was real, but that the world around us was unreal. It had no reality to it. It was ephemeral. It was not real.
Now, he brought transcendental meditation to the United States. What is the, and you said that you wanted to become a meditation, what was it, teacher, practitioner?
A teacher, yeah, so I could teach people.
So certainly meditation has been around for, well, eons. I mean, it goes back, into many of the ancient wisdom teachings. What was the big difference in his method, if you will, of transcendental meditation as opposed to what is available, again, going back down through history, that many people practice today?
Right. Now, that's a wonderful question. The thing is, and I'm going to answer the question as to why it's unique, why transcendental meditation is unique. But before I say that, what I'm going to say is that meditation in itself was not available in 1959 when Maharishi first arrived on the shores of America. There was no meditation. There was no mantra. There was no yoga. I know that people probably can't even believe what I'm saying because you're too young to remember what it was like in 1959. And I'm not too young to remember. I actually do remember what it was like in 1959. And meditation was not a concept in the West, in America, that anybody knew about. Actually, Maharishi single-handedly transformed this culture by bringing these methods to the West, bringing meditation, bringing yoga, bringing mantra. Now, some people might argue with me. They're going to say, oh, well, what about Vivekananda? What about Yogananda? Well, those, yes, they did come to the West, and they did bring the teachings of India to the West, but very small following. very, very small compared to Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Maharishi actually managed to train enough teachers so that there were 6 million people that learned transcendental meditation throughout the world. It had a huge, huge effect on America and on the entire planet, as a matter of fact. Now, I'll answer your question about what is unique about transcendental meditation. Well, the main thing that's unique about transcendental meditation is that it's done in an easy and effortless way. Meditation before that, and before that, it obviously wasn't in America. It was overseas. It was in India that people practiced meditation. India and other places in the East, like China and Japan and other Eastern countries, that's where they practiced meditation. But what was emphasized way back was concentration or contemplation. What was emphasized was effort, a strictness, effort, concentrating. It was not easy and effortless to meditate. It was a difficult, rigorous discipline. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi taught this method, transcendental meditation, that was easy for anyone to do. It was effortless. As a matter of fact, if you put effort into it, that wasn't the method. The method was just so easy, and as a method of letting go. And it uses something called a mantra. A mantra is not unusual back at that time in India. But it certainly was unusual in the West. That word was not in the dictionary before Maharishi brought transcendental meditation to the West. So it does use a mantra, and that's not unique. Other forms of meditation have used mantra throughout the ages, but not used in the way that he taught it, not in a method of letting go, of transcending, of going from the conscious level of mind through the subconscious into the level of samadhi. Samadhi meaning evenness of mind and stillness of body, meaning that place of transcendental consciousness, transcendental awareness.
Hmm. Now, of course, India being part of Britain up until 1947, certainly there was an influence in the UK to I'm sure, some degree, because especially when we look around the influences of India in that country to this day, especially in regards to, say, the food, and obviously the intermingling of the peoples in terms of the various types of folks. I mean, I get surprised every once in a while, or I was early on. When I would watch either BBC News or we get Sky News here in Santa Barbara, we were able to get that online. And I see this very dark-skinned Briton speaking with a very strong British accent. And of course, you know, the stereotype is that the British people are pasty white individuals. There's no brown skin in the British culture, but obviously we've had this intermingling of peoples. So I'm wondering, in terms of the movement of this whole, I don't want to say attitude, but philosophy, if you will, of meditation and yoga and trying to find one's center and trying to it was sort of a Buddhist. For example, your first chapter, I love the title of your very first chapter, is very Buddhist. Losing the self to find the self reminds me, of course, of that experience that he had under the tree. And it's like, okay, if I stop looking for it, I'll find it, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what this philosophy is doing, is saying, look, you the harder, the more desperate. They used to say this to me when I was a kid, a young man seeking a date, that the more desperate you become to find someone, the least likely you are to find them.
That's true. That's true.
So what about the early influences of India into other parts of the world, not quite yet to the United States per se, and maybe I'm curious as to when Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's teaching, if you will, I don't know if it was named Transcendental Meditation at the time, but when he began, what was his beginning in all of this? Certainly, obviously, being born and raised in India, you're obviously going to be influenced by all that. But what about his upbringing? Can you share, enlighten us a little bit about him?
Absolutely. So Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was born on January 12th, 1918, which is exactly 100 years ago. And he was born in a mud hut in a place in central India near Bhopal, small town. And his father was in revenue service. He was in tax service, civil servant. And his uncle was very spiritual and told him, and Maharishi was always liked to meet great saints, and he would travel here and there to meet various sadhus, meaning renunciates who were traveling through the area. And his uncle told him about a very great saint who would be in a nearby town. And when he heard about it, of course, he wanted to meet this great saint. And he went with some of his childhood friends. And he was a teenager at the time. And so his uncle told him, well, you have to go late at night and kind of sneak in. And so they arrived about 11:30 at night. And when they got to this hut or this house where the saint was staying, the guard there tried to shoo them away, like, why are you here? Why have you come? And, you know, they just kind of said, well, please tell us about the saint and we want to hear. And so, of course, they got the brush off, but then they didn't leave. So finally, after some time, the secretary relented. And after going upstairs and getting permission, he came back down and said, come with me, don't say a word. So they went upstairs and they went onto a balcony there where there were some people sitting in the dark. And at the time, the youngster, his name was Mahesh. Mahesh became Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. So Mahesh sat down quietly, and there were a few people there, but he couldn't see anything. Then all of a sudden, there was some headlights from a car that briefly illumined the balcony and illumined the face of this great saint that was sitting there. And Maharishi, within his heart, he said, oh, this is the sun, you know, like the sun had come out. And he immediately, as soon as he saw the face of this saint, he immediately surrendered to him, and he felt, this is it, he's my guru. So afterwards, he spoke to the saint and asked him if he could be of service. In other words, he asked if he could join him. And the saint, his name, he's called Guru Dev, meaning, and a lot of all the gurus in India are called Guru Dev, meaning hail to the great teacher. So he, and his actual name was Brahmananda Saraswati. That was the name of this saint. So the saint said to Mahesh, well, you have to finish college first before you can come and join me. So Mahesh went to college in Allahabad, and he graduated in physics. That was his field. And then he joined his guru. And by that time, Brahmananda Saraswati had become Shankaracharya of the North, which is meaning he was the head of the Hindu religion. There are four major heads of the Hindu religion, north, south, east, west, and he was the one established in the north, in the Himalayas. And so Maharishi joined him and lived with him and became, he served in his ashram until 1953, when the guru died. And then, well, there's a dramatic story about his, about the death of the guru, how he was, there was a great celebration and he was taken to Banaras. Now they call it Varanasi. And when his casket was put into the river Ganges, he was not cremated, because saints in India are not cremated. So his casket was lowered into the river. And when that happened, Maharishi dove into the river, held onto the casket until it went down to the bottom of the river. People thought he had committed suicide because he didn't come up for a really long time. Finally, he came up and bowed in reverence, and then he went into silence for about a year. And he went to the Himalayas and he went into silence. And then he had this inkling within his mind that he must go to the south of India. And he just had this feeling that that's what he should do. So eventually he did. He went to the south of India. He started teaching meditation there. And people were having amazing results. And then there was a big celebration of the 89th birthday of his guru in South India. And at that celebration, Maharishi talked about the great effects of meditation that people were getting. At the time, he called it deep meditation, actually, deep meditation. And people were having such amazing effects that at that celebration, when there were 10,000 people there, they were all gathered in a field. And so after he described the effects, and people were clapped, they clapped for like 5 minutes. They were so amazed at all the things he was talking about and the great effects that this meditation was having on people. So he said, well, if this is the response from nature, I'm going to inaugurate the spiritual regeneration movement. So that's what he did. He inaugurated that. And not too long after that, that was in 1958. And then by 1959, he left India and started his first world tour, traveling around the world. Now, you mentioned Great Britain. Actually, he was very, very well received in Great Britain. In fact, that was the place where people responded most to him in Great Britain. And also, interestingly, they responded at first very greatly in South America, not so much in the United States and North America as these other countries.
Hmm. Well, it's a fascinating story, to say the least. We want to continue here as we're talking with Dr. Susan Shumsky, and we're talking about her latest book, Maharishi and Me, and this has to do with the 50th anniversary, of course, of the Beatles and their, shall we say, introduction to this philosophy of transcendental meditation, seeking enlightenment with the Beatles guru. Susan Shumsky is my guest. We ask you to stay with us. We'll give her website here shortly because we want you to get more information and so forth. So stay with us. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and this is an incredible conversation we're having here. We hope you'll stay with us.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we're talking with Dr. Susan Shumsky. We're talking about her latest work, her latest book about Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and this is Maharishi and Me, and having to do basically with seeking enlightenment with the Beatles guru. And we're talking, of course, about his life as well as hers back in the 60s, early 70s. My introduction, Susan, was to especially Indian philosophy and meditation and yoga and so forth, as with some was through Autobiography of a Yogi. That was my first introduction. And of course, we've had a number of individuals who have come from the East, come from India in particular, from Paramahansa, and of course, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. I'm curious as to what connection, if any, there is to one individual who gained a great deal of, I will put it kindly, publicity in the 80s and 90s, especially. And he went, I remember the I can't remember the guru's name, but went by Osho. And he had an ashram, I believe it was up in Washington. Do you remember that?
Yes. Osho, his name was Rajneesh.
Rajneesh,
he had an ashram in Oregon.
Oregon, yes.
Yeah. And he was making people into what they call themselves sannyasis. Sannyasi is a term, an Indian term, for a renunciate, for somebody who has renounced the world. However, Rajneesh was a tantric master, and tantra is one of the paths in India, but it's a different, unusual path. It's a very different kind of path. And he was a great intellect, actually, a great, great intellect, and he wrote many, many books. And well, actually, I think his books mostly are just his talks that they published into books. But he has a lot of books out, and his books are really very good. And he was quite an amazing individual. But he's well known in the West for the fact that he had a lot of Rolls Royces, mm-hmm. collected Rolls Royces. So people criticized him for that.
I was going to say, it seemed to be a little incongruous to say maybe the philosophy that people thought, you know, was non-material, and yet here he had all of these cars.
Yeah, well, Tantra is not non-material, though. That mm-hmm. particular path in India is a path of, it's like opposite to what you might think yoga should be. But in fact, it is a path of yoga. It's just, you go about it, it's like they call it, some people call it a left-hand path. It's a different path. And it's a path of greater and greater material acquisition and greater material pleasure, and to go that way rather than the opposite direction. So obviously, that's not going to really play too well with people in the West, because people in the West are, well, how? What was this country founded on? Puritanism. Mm. The people here are very uptight. They're very puritanical. Mm-hmm. And Rajneesh said, oh, well, go have sex, you know, go have sex with everybody. So it was, you know, he was controversial to say the least, but he was quite an amazing saint. And Maharishi had a debate with him one time. I talk about this in my book, Maharishi and Me. And during their debate, they were debating their philosophies. And as they were debating, they got into quite a heated discussion, and they were like, started to insult each other and make faces at each other. It was actually quite amusing, but the people were not amused that were there, because both Maharishi's followers and Rajneesh's followers were present at the time. It happened in 1969 in Kashmir. And it was outdoors, and they're debating and debating. And so the people who were their followers became very agitated, because they felt like they needed to defend their own gurus. Mm. And they started standing up and shouting and saying things. And they started to get into the heated argument themselves. And then all of a sudden, Maharishi and Rajneesh stopped their debate. They stood up and they walked out arm in arm. Mm. So it was all just a game to them.
Right.
You know, they weren't taking it seriously.
Do you find that, and from your perspective and others who have followed the teachings, especially of Transcendental Meditation of Maharishi, that some people get lost in the personality? And the whole point was the message that he was bringing, just as, you know, Jesus never asked anybody to follow him. He asked them to follow the philosophy that he brought, as have many mm-hmm. messengers of God down through the ages. Do you feel that these days, just as then, that people get caught up in the personality and kind of miss they kind of miss the message?
Well, I think that in the case of transcendental meditation and Maharishi, the vast majority of the people are practicing transcendental meditation, who are practicing meditation, don't really, it's not a personality cult for them. They're just practicing TM because it's helping them, it's benefiting them. In fact, in my case, it really saved my life in so many ways. However, I personally got caught up in the personality, the cult of personality, very, very much so. That's why I ended up living with him for such a long time. But other people, no, they didn't have that kind of deep personal devotion to him as I had. And I was very, very, very devoted to him on a personal level. It's like I worshipped him. And I'm not sure how healthy that was, but he eventually said, "You have to leave because you're too dependent on me."
Mm. Yeah, I find that interesting as well because eventually, one day, if the natural course of things takes place, he and every notable individual that one would quote unquote follow. It's going to die. They're going to be gone. And then what are you left with if you don't have that core of the philosophy that was brought and make it your own? It's one of the things that I found interesting. First of all, in terms of, for example, Jesus never asked anybody, A, to follow, nor to become part of any religious organization, plus the fact that he was a Jew, never converted to Christianity. And I've often thought that if I was really going to be a follower, I need to become a Jew because he was a Jew, right?
True. He was a Jew. He was a rabbi.
Yeah.
And he couldn't possibly convert, quote unquote, Christianity because there was no Christianity.
Exactly.
I mean, they made him into a god. He certainly wasn't trying to be one. So they really misunderstood Jesus. But,
indeed,
you know, that's par for the course. That
sure
happens. It's happened throughout the ages. Almost every religion was started by someone who people misinterpreted, and then they decided to worship that person rather than worship God. So, mm-hmm, you know, that happens.
Tell us about how a Maharishi and transcendental meditation saved your life.
Okay, well, it was the 60s. I was a hippie. I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was taking drugs, psychedelics, like the rest of us who were following the teachings of Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who later became Ram Dass. And we were reading, you know, The Psychedelic Experience, which is the book that they wrote. And Leary was telling us to turn on, tune in, and drop out. And they were extolling the virtues of psychedelics for reaching higher states of consciousness and altered states of consciousness. So I was seeking that too. That's what I was doing. I was a flower child. And we who were flower children, we were seeking nirvana. We were seeking this experience of spiritual awakening, spiritual enlightenment. And I was reading all the books about that. I was reading the Buddhist scriptures and many different books about higher consciousness. And I was reading The Way of Zen and other books by Alan Watts. And in those books, it said that you had to find a meditation guide. Well, in 1966 in Berkeley, California, you didn't exactly go to the yellow pages and find meditation guide or anything remotely similar to that. There was no, like I said, there's no yoga, there's no nothing back then. So I asked a roommate, well, how do I find this meditation guide? And he said, well, have you ever tried to meditate yourself? So I said, well, I'll give it a shot. And so I lay down on my bed and I sort of prayed for or asked for a meditation. Immediately, I was propelled into this ecstatic state. I was feeling this rush of energy rushing from the tips of my toes all the way to the top of my head, and I felt like I was plugged into an electric socket. And I figured, well, hey, I guess this is meditation. I was so clueless. First of all, I didn't even know you're supposed to sit up when you meditate. I lay on my bed. Second of all, you know, I didn't know what meditation was. And I didn't know that I had just had my first meditation experience and also Kundalini awakening all at the same time. But this happened after I had been taking drugs and I actually went insane taking drugs. I actually had a mental breakdown from taking drugs, from taking LSD specifically, mm-hmm. not drugs, from right. LSD. I had a mental breakdown when I took LSD. I never came down from the trip. I went insane. I was hearing voices. I was having hallucinations. The trip never ended. And it was a very frightening, horrifying experience. In fact, I even scared the psychiatrist that I went to. He was terrified just hearing about my experiences. So I guess he wasn't a very good psychiatrist. But in any case, it was very strange. And meditation is really what saved me. And then after I had that first experience of meditation, I really still wanted to find a meditation guide because I wanted to be able to actually do real meditation and have a method for that. So a friend took me to the Transcendental Meditation Center, which was really just a building because there was no teacher there. But he took me there and I saw the picture of Maharishi on the wall. And as soon as I saw his picture, I thought, this is it. I know this is the one. I'm going to learn meditation finally. So I had to wait for 9 months before I could learn because, like I said, there was no meditation teacher there. But finally, the meditation teacher came and I learned TM, Transcendental Meditation, and it saved my life because no longer was I mentally ill. No longer was I having these horrid experiences, even though, well, I had already gotten a little better, but it really did save my life.
Hmm. Well, we find some incredible openings for moving forward in our lives, and you obviously found one to keep you going as well. And now you are where you are today and providing inspiration and insight and hopefully education as well to those who are seeking and trying to find their way through this life. How has, aside from obviously saving your life, over the course of the years that you have been practicing TM, how has it changed and or guided and or helped you through? And have there ever been experiences where you have used it and you didn't quite get, in that particular instance, what you were looking for through it or from it, through the practice? Have there ever been those difficult times when it just wasn't working?
Okay, so Transcendental Meditation is a wonderful meditation technique. I very much recommend it to people. I had only incredible positive experiences with it. All of my experiences with Transcendental Meditation have been astounding and amazing from the very first that I learned it, which was in 1967 during the Summer of Love. In August of 1967, that's when I learned TM. And I immediately was so impressed with the effects, with the positive effects in my life, that I immediately wanted to become a meditation teacher and started volunteering at the TM Center. I was really gung-ho. In fact, I was annoying everybody around me by how... trying to propagate DM to everyone. So people were like, can't you just shut up about this already? So I was really very enamored with the whole method, and it really I took to it, you know, dark water. I totally took to it immediately. And I practiced it for 22 years. It was fabulous. Now I practice something else, which I also think is an incredible method that I teach, which is called Divine Revelation. However, I never had anything but incredibly positive, wonderful experiences with TM, and it was just so easy and effortless to do. I loved it, and I recommend it to people.
Hmm. Can you describe for us, is this even possible, the process, or at least initially the process of TM?
Sure. So you just sit down in a chair and you are you're using something called a mantra. A mantra is a sound. It's actually a very ancient sound that's used in India, very common. By the way, people think that TM mantras are very, you know, unique or something, but they're not. They're typical, traditional mantras used in India. And a mantra is actually a name of a deity is what it is. And you just use that mentally. You repeat it mentally. But the thing that's unique about TM is that you repeat it in an effortless way. And you let it go. When it goes, it goes. And then you come back to it. You come back to it. And then you let it go again. It's not like you try to force the mind to concentrate on that mantra. You keep letting it go. And that takes your mind, allows the mind to drift from the level of the outer environment, from the conscious level, down through the subconscious level into transcendental awareness or transcendental consciousness, which is called samadhi. Samadhi means evenness of mind and stillness of body, into a state that's called Satchitananda or absolute bliss consciousness. So that's how you do it. You use this mantra, and the mantra is given to you by the teacher, but not just the mantra. The teacher guides you into the process. So that's why you have to learn it one-on-one individually, because you learn it. You don't learn it in a big group. You learn it individually. And they guide you into that ability to be able to settle down to that state of inner peace, that state of transcendental awareness. Mm-hmm. It's a really good technique.
Now, I like having my guests in studio. The energy is different, the dynamic, the conversation is more intimate in that respect. I have no problem doing interviews using Skype or a landline, whatever it takes to be able to share the information that folks have. So I'm curious as to the practice of TM and teaching it to others, if the electronic forms of communication are helpful, but it is always better to be face-to-face in the same room with the person or people whom you are teaching this technique?
You know, that's an interesting question. Transcendental meditation, specifically, is not taught electronically. You have to go and take a class, and you have to be in the room with the teacher. And they also, there's a puja ceremony involved with it. Puja ceremony is a traditional ceremony in India where you make offerings and they ask the student to bring a white handkerchief and a fruit and some fruit and some flowers. So the student participates in the ceremony. And that's part of the reason why it's done one-on-one, you know, and why it's done live.
Very interesting.
And by the way, yes, to answer your question, yes, there's a vibration that comes from doing the ceremony. Mm-hmm. And that's because the ceremony is an invocation of an ancient tradition of masters.
Is there any other technique of any kind that you are aware of that compares to transcendental meditation? And or maybe even how can I put this? Maybe rivals it in any way, shape, or form? Or do you find this is, if I can put it in this way, and I mean this very respectfully, the end-all and be-all of meditation forms?
Well, obviously, I don't think it's the end-all and be-all, or I wouldn't be practicing something else. I haven't practiced transcendental meditation since approximately 1989 or so.
Mm-hmm.
I've been practicing something called divine revelation, and that's what I teach. And the reason I teach it is because I love it, and I think it's a very simple way to experience the divine presence and to develop spiritually. But I'm, like I said, I'm a fan of transcendental meditation. I think it's great. and anybody can do it, and anyone can learn it, and I think it's a wonderful technique. And now, as far as how that compares with other meditations, like I said, there's something unique about it in that it's done effortlessly. Before transcendental meditation was taught by Maharishi in the West, most of the meditations that were taught in India were about concentration, discipline, very strict. You know, you had to renounce a lot of things and also, you know, give up your home, you know, and go and live in a forest and be with a guru. And it was just there's a lot of discipline and a lot of giving up and renunciation involved. And then the techniques, you know, they were mostly, okay, we have to focus. We have to concentrate on this one thing, or we have, you know, I think the method that Maharishi taught was very different from what was being taught at that time in India.
Hmm. I think that one of the things that I find so interesting is the path that people have taken, and yours obviously took you as far away as India. When, after, you said it was 22 years that you spent with the yogi, what was the next step in your life after that, in terms of then incorporating TM into your life and then moving forward? Where did you go from there?
Well, when I left, I lived in his various ashrams for 22 years. And at the end of that time, I was living in Fairfield, Iowa, which is one of his main places where people are together in large groups meditating together at what at that time was called Maharishi International University. It's now called Maharishi University of Management. It's in Fairfield, Iowa, and people are still there meditating together. And I had learned something else that I really, really thought was amazing, this practice that I call Divine Revelation. And I started teaching that. And eventually I left Fairfield, Iowa, and was teaching this other method. And then eventually I started writing books. My first book was called Divine Revelation, which came out in 1996. And I have 14 books in print now. You know, I've written a lot of books since then and done a lot of teaching since then, teaching this other method. I certainly did not follow in my guru's footsteps, because he had created this gigantic organization, and that's not something that I wanted to do. So I did not want to have a big organization, because I saw what happens when you have a big organization, and I didn't like the results of that. So I avoided that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously I've taught a lot less people because I didn't have a big organization, but that's fine. I've been following my own heart, following my inner guidance, and I've had a very fulfilling life as a result of that.
Tell us about Divine Revelation. What is it, and how does it work, and so forth? And where's it come from?
Well, I learned it from two people in San Diego called Ann and Peter Meyer. And, you know, nobody knows who they are. No one knows about their organization. It was very small, still is. And it's really just a way to listen to the still small voice of God within, and to receive inner divine guidance, to become one with spirit and experience our higher self, experience who we really are, simply by meditating in a very, very simple way, and by asking and praying and receiving. And it's the entire process is based on one thing, and that is ask and it shall be given unto you. So it's a matter of asking and going deep within through asking for the experience of the divine presence, and asking to receive divine guidance, to receive the message of spirit. So it's very powerful, and I like it.
Mm. And what are the benefits of divine revelation?
Well, really, I had a huge change that came over me as a result of divine revelation. So much more self-confidence, so much more self-awareness, so much more the direct experience of God and being able to communicate with that still small voice when you're able to receive divine guidance and ask any question and receive the answer to any question. That really changes you because you have tremendous confidence knowing that you're making wise decisions, the best decisions, wise decisions with peaceful confidence. And miracles just happen in life, a lot of miracles taking place day by day as a result of listening to the inner guidance and following the inner guidance and doing what Spirit, with a capital S, guides you to do. So it's powerful, and it's just been a big change in my life as a result of that. And I've been practicing that, well, since 1989, so what's that, almost 30 years? I don't know. It's been a long time.
And this is something that anybody has access to, can learn, and incorporate it into their lives.
Yes. Yeah, people can learn it. And actually, you can learn it from my books. You don't even have to have a teacher to learn it.
Right.
I have some books. One is Divine Revelation. Another one is called Awaken Your Divine Intuition. Another is called Awaken Your Third Eye. Those are the books, main books, where you can learn this method of divine revelation. And you can learn it from a book, or you can learn it from a teacher. You can learn it from me or one of the teachers that's listed on my website.
You have two sites here. One is Dr. Susan, drsusan.org, as well as divinetravels.org. .com, actually. Mm-hmm. DivineTravels.com. Tell us about that one. What about the Divine Travels? That that's interesting.
So that's what pays the bills. My life is DivineTravels.com. And that is about traveling to sacred destinations. For example, we have a tour coming up to Peru coming up this June. And we have a tour, we have a cruise to Tahiti coming up in August. And these are all spiritual travels. In other words, travel with a purpose, not just travel to have a vacation, but travel to visit a sacred destination, a place that's a spiritual vortex, or to visit, to go on a cruise ship and have a conference at sea, that kind of thing. Mm. So, you know, it's very, it's a lot of fun and spiritual vacation. So that's what Divine Travels is.
You know, you mentioned some sites, some locations around the globe. And growing up in the United States myself, the only quote unquote divine place that I was aware of growing up in Arizona was Sedona, referring to a vortices or a vortex that existed there. I've seen pictures of it in the 21st century. Doesn't look anything like it did when I used to visit there in the 80s and 90s, which is really kind of unfortunate, very commercial now. But I've heard that aside from like places like, oh, I don't know, Stonehenge, which I've not been to, or on a cruise to the Western Caribbean, we stopped off at the Tulum ruins, which were really fascinating to me as we walked through the sites and so forth there. But there are so many around the world, but a lot of folks are unaware that there are some sacred sites, even in the United States, that, you know, we haven't really been made aware of. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, I've been to all those places you mentioned, yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, I've taught in those places, too. I taught retreats for many, many years in Sedona and also in Mount Shasta, California, which is another spiritual, very spiritual place. Mm-hmm. And the Tetons is another place I've taught, which is another incredibly spiritual vortex, spiritual place. But there are a lot of spiritual places, obviously, in the United States and all over the world. So that's what Divine Travels is taking us to some of these amazing places. And Machu Picchu is one of them, and also India. I mean, I've taken people to India quite a number of times, to the Kumbh Mela specifically, which is a huge festival.
Yeah.
It's a spiritual festival that happens in India on a regular basis. And I've taken a lot of people there to that amazing event.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd be able to handle that because I'm not a real fan of crowds these days.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that go to the Kumbh Mela.
Yeah.
But it's also a big area, so it's not like you're just, you know, crowded or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a huge, huge encampment. I mean, there's just like in the one that's in Allahabad, which is the biggest one, it's 30 acres. So it's huge. Yeah. Or I'm sorry, that's completely wrong. 30 square miles.
Wow.
30 square miles.
That is huge. That is huge.
It's really, really ginormous camps, and all the great saints come from everywhere, all over India, and they set up camps there, and you can just sit with them in their tents and receive the blessings of all these amazing saints. So it's pretty cool.
Well,
these are some of the travels that we offer with Divine Travels, but mainly over the last several years since 2011, and mostly it's been cruise ship.
Mm-hmm.
Cruise ship seminars on cruise ships.
Let me ask you about your impressions, your observations, your insights into man's evolution. We already know where we've been, and sadly, we haven't learned a whole lot from our own history because we keep repeating it. So I'm curious as to your observations of our evolution forward. What do you see as our future in terms of humanity and transcending this dualistic fight or flight, kill or be killed mentality that just seems to not want to go away?
Well, the reason why people incarnate into human form is because they're in ignorance. That's the main reason that people incarnate. If they were not in ignorance, they wouldn't be incarnating into the human condition, shall we say. So the reality is that this, whatever, this kill or be killed, that's just part of life. I mean, people eat, animals eat, mm-hmm. everyone eats. All right. So something is killed, even if it's a vegetable. The vegetable mm-hmm. is killed mm-hmm. in order for us to eat it. So that is what life is. It's part of what life is. Not really all of what life is, obviously. The reason that we have incarnated is to realize our true self, to realize who we really are. And who we really are is not who we think we are. Who we think we are is our history, our beliefs, our habits, our conditioning, our profession, our bank account, the clothes we wear, what we look like. That's what we think we are, but it's not who we really are. Who we really are is a magnificent divine being with great power, great energy, great strength. Who we really are is divine. And and we're here to realize that. We're here to get away from this field of ignorance into a state of enlightenment. And it's possible for everyone to realize their true self. All they need is a desire for that. The thing is that the desire for that is very rare. Mm-hmm. There aren't really very many people who want to find out who they really are. But there are some people who do, and they do find that. They do find out who they really are through doing some spiritual practices.
Then do you find that if that's the case, that they will probably choose not to come back here again because they won't be at that level of ignorance that would cause them to want to come back here again? Or maybe they'd come back here to help some who are ignorant, who are interested in growing and evolving, if you will, spiritually and moving forward so as to sort of break their personal cycles or spiritual cycle.
Exactly. Everything you've said is exactly true.
Okay.
That's exactly how it works.
Dr. Susan Chomsky is my guest here on the program, and I want to thank you so much for giving us so much time. I also extend to you an invitation should you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area. We'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. And I encourage people to go to your website, drsusan.org, and find out more about not only Maharishi and Me, the book that we've been talking about early in the early part of this interview, as well as other things and the other 14 or 13 books that you have out as well. And we encourage folks also maybe go to TheDivineTravels.com website and find out what's available and get on one of those cruise ships. I mean, I've only been on two cruises back in the 90s, and they were great fun. I think this would be real interesting for folks. And before we let you go, in addition to our thanks to you for giving us so much time, also have three final questions for you that I ask my guests. And you've probably touched upon them a little bit throughout the interview, but I'd like to ask you these directly. The first one is, who is Susan Chomsky?
Susan Chomsky is just a facade. The real person is not this body, is not this facade. The real me is inner divinity. The real me is the same as is within all beings and all things, and that is the spark of the divine.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
What I'd like to achieve is for people to be inspired to discover who they really are and to realize God within them and to experience that directly. I mean, to have an actual real experiences of who they are, and not just an aha, but an actual day by day, hour by hour experience of their inner divinity.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose is to help people to awaken to their true self, is to help people to realize who they really are and to express their true divine purpose and destiny on this planet, is to help others to discover why they're here and to fulfill that destiny day by day.
Again, Dr. Susan Chomsky, I thank you so much for joining us on the program. We really do appreciate you and the work that you're doing, as well as the information that you've shared here on this program about yourself. And it's an extraordinary time in your life and the lives of others who were there with you during that period. And again, thanks so much.
You're welcome, and thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.